This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Former First Lady Barbara Bush clearly had some very important conversations with her family and her doctors long before the world learned that she would end her fight against a terminal illness. The Bush family announced that she would seek comfort care, and this week she died at the age of 92. End-of-life choices can be difficult, but not making them in time can leave families and doctors in distress when crisis comes. And there are many things that can muddy the decision-making process. Modern medicine offers many options for prolonging life, but how well do we deal with letting it end? We asked you for your experiences in making end-of-life decisions. Here's what some of you left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Abby, and I'm calling from Houston. I think one of the hardest things was having to make some end-of-life decisions for my daughter, who was in the NICU for almost a year. She ended up not passing away and is thriving, but we needed to make all sorts of decisions about when we needed to end things, how we would end things, burial things, things we hadn't even thought through for ourselves as adults. It was gut-wrenching and very, very complicated.
Hi, this is Bob in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and my mom of age 92 recently passed away back in January, and we were struggling with the end-of-life care, and it was that the thought that my brother and I both had, and thankfully I had my brother to go over these things with, is that there was no joy left in my mother's life. And when it came to a point where she was just unable to handle daily life, it was the hospice care that suggested the end-of-life care. We made the good decision, and we are happy she is in a better place.
This is Margaret from St. Louis. I am facing hospice decisions for my parents, particularly my mother. And it seems that the most difficult aspect of making a hospice decision is everybody acknowledging that a hospice decision is necessary. I think that is the biggest challenge, and that is why so many people enter hospice and only spend a couple of days in it before passing away. I don't think that delaying the decision is the best choice.
Well, thank you, Margaret and Bob and Abby, for sharing your stories. You know, modern medicine offers many options for prolonging life. Today, we'll talk about how we deal with letting life end. That's just ahead.
Ever listen to the news and wonder, is there anything good happening out there? I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World. And each week, Guy Raz and I take you and your kids on wild adventures to explore the most wow-worthy news stories on the planet. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts.
Joining us here in studio is Rosemary Gibson, a senior advisor at the Hastings Center, which is a bioethics research institute. She is the author of Treatment Trap: How the Overuse of Medical Care is Wrecking Your Health and What You Can Do to Prevent It. And she led the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's initiative to bring palliative care into the nation's hospitals. Rosemary, welcome to 1A.
Joshua, it's great to be here.
Also with us in studio is a name that many fans of public radio might know. Diane Rehm is working on a film about aid in dying called When My Time Comes. 1A is the successor to The Diane Rehm Show, which she hosted for 37 years. Currently, she hosts a weekly podcast called Diane Rehm On My Mind. Diane, welcome.
Joshua, so good to be here.
And joining us from La Crosse, Wisconsin, is Bud Hammes, a clinical ethicist and executive director of Respecting Choices. The group provides a model for advanced care planning that's being replicated across the country. Bud, glad to have you with us.
Joshua, thanks for having me.
Diane Rehm, let me start with you. Can you talk about just the significance of Barbara Bush publicly disclosing her choice to move forward with comfort care? I feel like a lot of people said, that's so brave, that's so noble, that she'd be willing to talk about that, be that transparent. How did you view it when the family made that announcement?
First of all, I want to say what a marvelous woman Barbara Bush was. I spoke with her back in 1994, and once again, she shows herself as courageous, forethinking, that the end of her life she wanted to spend at home. She knew that whatever medical assistance could come later would not cure her, would not make her better, and she was ready to say, I'm ready to let it go.
She kind of, Diane, allowed the rest of us to talk about it in a way. It's not the kind of thing that we, I think understandably, but not the kind of thing we really want to talk about until it's too late, but then that's kind of the problem.
Joshua, that's exactly the problem, that families fear talking about death. Death is part of life, and we as individuals need to acknowledge that, talk about it with our families, which certainly my late husband John Rehm and I had talked about a great deal with our two children. So when the time came, they understood he was ready to go.
I do want to get more into that conversation as well. But Rosemary, before I come to you, I should note, for those of you who are listening, who are thinking about sharing your stories, thinking about asking questions, we get that this is really hard to talk about. And there may be aspects of what you want to discuss that you're not fully ready to disclose. If there are certain things that you feel like you need to leave out or gloss over just gently, that's fine. You don't owe us full disclosure of every bit and piece of your story if we can be helpful to you in thinking this through. So whatever form your story comes out in, it's fine. We'd rather you share it with us and your questions, 1A@WAMU.org. Rosemary Gibson, what's the difference between palliative? We've heard this term palliative care, and we've heard the term comfort care. Can you just give us a basic definition? Are they the same thing, or are they slightly different?
Sure. Palliative care is comfort care. Physicians and nurses who provide palliative care are skilled. They've been trained in how to relieve suffering, whether it's physical pain, whether it's shortness of breath, which can be so terrifying to the person experiencing it, and to loved ones who have to watch their mother, their father, their sister have a tough time to breathe. So they're skilled in helping relieve those symptoms. They're also skilled, Joshua, in helping people have a conversation. They're skilled in asking the right questions. It's not, do I want the full court press? They don't ask, do you want me to do everything? Those aren't the right questions, but skilled palliative care physicians and nurses know to ask, what's important to you? And everybody can answer that question.
Diane, let me come back to you and your conversations with John. Can you speak a little bit more about the way that you two discussed what to do? First of all, if you could give us a sense of how these conversations came about, whether you were ready for them, not ready for them, and then what the conversations involved.
Joshua, there were a number of deaths in both John's and my family's, and therefore we were both ready to talk, not only with each other, but with our children about what we wanted for ourselves. And when John's time came, he had Parkinson's disease. He could no longer feed himself. He could no longer stand on his own. He could no longer bathe himself, toilet himself. He said, my time has come. He said to his doctor, to his two children, one of whom is a doctor, a physician herself, I am ready to die. And the doctor said, here in Maryland, because we do not have right to die laws, I cannot help you. So my husband did the only thing he could do. He stopped eating, he stopped taking medication, he stopped drinking water. Everyone knows you can live a long time with no food, but without water, the organs begin to fail quickly. Sadly, in John Rehm's case, it took 10 days for him to die. And it was only at the end of that period that morphine was given for what seemed to be a show of pain on his face. And that is why I am out there so vehemently arguing for right to die laws in every state around the country, the latest of which to grant that is Hawaii. We have it here in the District of Columbia, but Joshua, you will be interested to know that thus far, not one doctor has registered to be a physician who will help patients. I've talked with D.C. City Council person, Mary Che, about this, and it is a problem because doctors do not want to come forward and help patients.
Bud Hamas, I wonder if you could jump in here, particularly in light of what you're doing in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I don't know what the laws are like in Wisconsin regarding aid in dying, but La Crosse has had a lot of success in getting people to talk about advanced directives or some similar documentation. As I understand it, nationally, as of 2014, only about 3 out of 10 adults had some kind of advanced directive. In La Crosse, Wisconsin, it's 96%. So I imagine you'd have some insights on how to make conversations like this and plans like this easier, hopefully, for families and for doctors.
Agreed. So just a point of clarification, the 96% is not in the general population, but at the time of death.
Gotcha.
So
96% of people at the time of their death had an advance directive. Is that it?
They had a written care plan, but probably as importantly, not only did we have a plan in place, the plan was actually in the medical record of the health organization who was caring for the person or patient at the time they died. So if they died in a nursing home versus a home hospice versus the hospital, it didn't matter where the site of death was. The plan was always with the patient, and the treatment provided, whether that treatment was requesting more aggressive care or less aggressive care, the treatment provided was consistent with the preferences 99% of the time. So these, to me, are the gold standards. We should have an extremely high prevalence of planning documented in the medical record, available to the health professionals caring for the patient at the place that's occurring, and the treatment should be consistent with those preferences almost all of the time.
But I wonder if you could help us think through some of the things that would go into a living will. I have a living will, thanks to my partner, and who said we need to do this, and it was excruciating to think through death. I realized how hard it is for me to think about it because it's not something I think about. I'm kind of more worried about day-to-day life than the end of it. But it's essential. And I think now that I've done it, it's not nearly as bad as I thought it would be. But what kinds of things should people be thinking about now to make the process of putting some kind of directive together easier later?
Right. This is a big question. And in La Crosse, with our work now over almost 25 years, we've come to the realization that asking people when they're healthy to plan for everything in the future is, first of all, impossible, and secondly, unnecessary. So when people are generally healthy, what we want them to do is think about two decisions. The first is, who would make my decisions if I became incapable and unable to make my decisions? And this is actually a more complicated process of decision-making than you first think. And then second of all, how bad would a serious and permanent brain injury have to be for me to want the goals of care to change from prolonging my life to keeping me comfortable? Those are the two things we think that everyone should do when they're younger and healthier. But as people get sicker, like Barbara Bush, then the realities of a specific disease trajectory come forward. And you can say, okay, now that I have this congestive heart failure and I'm being hospitalized on a routine basis and maybe putting it on a ventilator, how much more do I want to do of this? And so planning is an ongoing process through one's life. And you can start with what we call a basic plan, which protects you in case of unexpected things. You have a decision maker, you know what's going to happen or what you want to happen if you have this serious permanent brain injury. And then as you get diagnosed with diseases that progress over time, there's more planning that will occur, and the plan can become more specific regarding your values and goals in light of the progression of your illness.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. So, Bud, I just want to repeat those two things just to make sure we're clear. The two things people should think through are who would make my decisions and how bad would a serious permanent brain injury have to be to trigger someone else beginning to make those end-of-life decisions. Is that it?
That's it. And what I would say about picking someone is we witnessed this. I witnessed this personally as a clinical ethicist at Gunderson Health System. People would pick someone they love and they live closely to. And those are understandable criteria. But here are the things you should be thinking about. Is this person willing to carry this role, a responsibility? Are they willing to actually talk with me in depth about my values and goals? Will they follow what I say regardless of whether they agree or not? And finally, can they make very difficult, complex decisions sometimes in stressful situations? The person you pick should be able to do all four of those things. If they can't, you should think about another selection or another person.
How to start the conversation is one critical issue. And that is, if your parents are aging, say, Mom and Dad, I've been thinking about myself, what I want at the end of life. I'd really like to know what you want.
Diane Rehm, the host of Diane Rehm on My Mind. Her forthcoming film is called When My Time Comes. Diane, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We'll get back to our conversation and more of your stories in a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
Hey, thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Peter Sagal. Come try the only show that treats the news the way it deserves to be treated, roughly, with lots of tasteless comments. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back now to our conversation. Rosemary Gibson and Bud Hammes are still with us. We'll add another voice to the panel, but first let me get to a few more of your stories and comments. Leah is listening in St. Louis, and Leah writes, "My father passed away a year ago after more than 2 months in hospice with diabetes. It's not lost on me how fortunate we were as a family for my father to be an active participant through the whole process of deciding his path. We were never left to wonder what he would want. I also exposed my then 5-year-old son to what was happening. We as a society do not speak openly enough about death and dying. My hope is that seeing the respect that was shown to my father at the end will allow my son to better accept death as a part of life." We also heard from some of you about how medical professionals made it more complicated to have your wishes honored. Here's one note that was left in our inbox.
My name is Beth. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. And recently, my mother made the choice to go into hospice care. She passed away in June of 2016, and it was a difficult decision for us, but not a difficult decision for her. She was a similar age as Barbara Bush and had lost several children and her spouse. She and the family made the decision to do this while she was in rehab, and the physical rehab people were blasted away by the whole idea that she would want to go and die. I think we need to do more in our country to help people pass away peacefully and to make their wishes known and to be confirmed through the healthcare system.
Beth, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Rosemary, what about that? As I understand it, one of the challenges with living wills, powers of attorney, any kind of end-of-life directives is that sometimes they're not followed, not just with pushback, but with almost like insurrection, that they just don't want to do what you've asked.
It's a big problem, Joshua. If you picked up a medical or nursing textbook just 20 years ago, you'd never know that anybody in this country, in this world, ever died.
They just don't talk about it.
They just didn't talk about it. That's changed a little bit, but the truth still is that to get through medical school, you have to demonstrate that you can help assist and deliver a baby, but you don't have to demonstrate competence in helping people leave this world or to have those kinds of conversations that we're talking about today about what's important to patients. And as a result, there are a lot of people who are in situations where they're getting medical care. They're in a treatment trap, and it's on a train going down the track, and they can try to pull the emergency brake, but the train just doesn't stop. It's very distressing to patients and their families.
Joining us now on the line is Dr. Jessica Zitter, an ICU and palliative care physician at Highland Hospital, a large public hospital in Oakland, California. She's the author of Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, and she was also featured in the Netflix documentary Extremis. Dr. Zitter, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you talk about this mentality among doctors that we've heard a lot about, this difficulty that physicians seem to have in dealing with death as well as they deal with life? Do you see that? And if so, what's that about?
I absolutely see that. And I actually think Rosemary just described it perfectly, this sort of treatment trap. I actually call it in my book, the end-of-life conveyor belt. That's something that I particularly see in the intensive care unit. And it's sort of this churning conveyor belt where we just kind of keep going along with protocols as people's organs start to fail. One by one, we attach them to, you know, ventilators if their breathing starts to have trouble, or their dialysis machines if their kidneys are starting to not do well. And I think that, you know, ultimately people get sort of encased in a whole bunch of machinery and treatments if we just allow the default approach to happen.
I get the sense, though you would know far better than I would, but I get the sense that part of this decision is emotional, just the idea that you have been trained to save lives and there's a life you can't save is kind of anathema to the idea of being a doctor. And part of it is administrative and economic, that hospitals are assessed based on their health outcomes and no one wants to keep their death rate as part of one of their outcomes because the job of a hospital is to bring you in and save your life, that there are economic and administrative reasons for just not wanting to talk about it because our record needs to feel as sterling as possible. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that it's a very, very complex problem. And, you know, sometimes people want to point to one specific issue or one variable that could be fixed and everything would be better. And I actually think you've sort of alluded to it. It's extremely complex. It's very, very complicated, both on an emotional level and on an infrastructural and financial compensation level. You're right. There's a 30-day mortality statistic for many types of surgeries. You know, people are judged. Doctors, surgeons are judged on how many of their patients who have had a particular procedure are alive at 30 days. And so that is, you know, right in and of itself, a concerning incentive to, you know, just keep automatically, patients connected to machinery to keep their bodies alive without any discussion, without any question, even if they're not doing well in those 30 days, intervening 30 days. The emotional piece that you've just alluded to is huge. I think people, you know, it's emotional or even counter-emotional. I mean, the fact is that, you know, we're taught to save lives. That's what we think is valued as being a doctor. We have all these siloed subspecialties where we learn specific techniques to counteract the failing physiology of a dying body. And I think, you know, we can't. It's not only that we feel like failures, but that our patients and their families may look at us as failures if we don't seem to be able to grab hold of the illness and turn it around. And and not only the failure issue emotionally, but the feeling of confronting emotion
Yeah.
It's very painful to watch a family that's desperate, where a patient is suffering and the family is emotional, and to not do something and to sit there with them and be there with them. It's very, very, very hard to sit still.
We heard from a number of you about your encounters with doctors when it comes time to make end-of-life decisions. Aaron wrote on our Facebook page, "Doctors are part of the problem. When my father, also a physician, decided to end his cancer treatments in favor of palliative care, some of his medical providers were outraged, even though his rare cancer was absolutely terminal. My only regret is we didn't bring hospice in earlier, and I now counsel people to use hospice early and often." We also heard from a cardiologist listening from Indiana, refers to himself as Dr. S. Dr. S. wrote about seeing an 85-year-old pancreatic cancer patient having a heart attack. Dr. S. writes, "There was disagreement between him and the patient's cancer doctor about how to proceed. The patient asked, 'What would you do if it were you?' Dr. S. writes, "When a patient asks this question, they almost always do whatever you suggest. But I answered honestly that I'd rather die than to go through last-ditch measures at his age." And he said, "Then that's what we'll do." The cancer doctor had been very angry at me, and I wasn't sure I had done the right thing. I could have prevented that patient's death that night. Dr. Zitter, walk us through the matrix of decisions that a doctor deals with when they're looking at a patient who is near death and who may well have said, "It's time to go." Can you talk through, just from your experience, say in Highland, you get a family from Lake Merritt who comes in and says, 88-year-old grandmother, we've already thought this through. Now's the time. We're going to pull the trigger on the plan. How does that work in the hospital?
Well, first of all, the unfortunate reality, I hate to throw cold water on it, is that most people have not done that, had those conversations. They haven't had the conversation that Barbara Bush had with her family. This advanced care planning isn't happening. You know, thank goodness there's, you know, respecting choices, and obviously La Crosse, Wisconsin is doing a great job. And, you know, we actually, even at our Kaiser facilities here in California, are using the respecting choices model to really encourage the Kaiser members to start doing advanced care planning. It's starting to happen more and more in the community, but unfortunately, we are not seeing it typically in the hospital. People haven't really thought about it. They haven't considered it. So what we end up doing, you know, in the intensive care unit is we end up having to have these conversations in those very serious extreme moments. And you see that in the movie Extremis, that, you know, it's not the most conducive environment to really sitting and carefully thinking about what somebody's preferences and values are. There's emotion, there's suffering, there's fear, there's panic. It's not a time to really be able to reflect on what's most important to you. So that scenario you described is rare, where someone comes in and says, "We know that this is important to mom." When that happens, that's also an important moment and piece of information for us to grab, and sometimes it goes unnoticed. We need to be, again, constantly reflecting with families and patients what is important to you, even, again, if we're in the intensive care unit, if we're in the emergency room, and trying to grasp at those pieces of information about what might have been important to that person in that particular type of scenario. And as soon as we hear that there may be preferences and values that were stated that are consistent with a comfortable, allowing a natural death, for example, we must take that seriously. Unfortunately, sometimes people have taken the effort and the time to fill out instructions saying that, you know, when my time comes, I don't want to be put on machines, and that can sometimes go unnoticed, and that's a very serious problem.
But Hamas, what do you see as the need in the healthcare system to address the way that we deal with end-of-life decisions? What's the one biggest thing you would like to see healthcare providers do in this regard?
Well, I think one of the big challenges is the lack of resources to do the kind of planning that's needed before the hospitalization occurs out in the outpatient setting. Here's where medical leaders and administrative leaders have to say, in the outpatient setting, we're going to dedicate resources so that that patients have the opportunity to do this planning, and give them the time to do that. Now, the value of that doesn't accrue, if you will, to the outpatient setting. And if we're simply paying physicians for productivity in the outpatient setting, this isn't some kind of productivity in the outpatient setting. The value comes to the patient and family when they face that crisis and now are prepared to make decisions. The second thing is that in our medical centers, we have to hold people accountable. So at Gunderson, when a patient dies in our hospital, an adult patient dies, the peer review committee looks at that death. And one of the things they look at is, did this person have a plan? Was it written down? Was it available? And was it properly followed and incorporated into decisions? And if they find an inconsistency between what the patient wanted and what the doctor did, and there's no good medical reason for that inconsistency, that's considered a medical error. And it's addressed by remediation and re-education of that physician, and it's not tolerated by the physicians in the medical group. So we need to provide opportunities for people to plan in the outpatient setting and provide the resources to do that. And we can afford to do that, and we can know how to do that. And then we have to hold, and first of all, we have to train physicians to know how to do this, mm-hmm. but also we have to hold them accountable.
Stephanie tweets, any suggestions for engaging with medical professionals and loved ones about end-of-life discussions when those loved ones are not ready to have those discussions? Sometimes feeling rushed can be traumatic, and many are not ready to go at the end of life. Rosemary, I wonder if you could take that one.
Well, I think of a person is has their values and preferences in mind, but their family isn't ready. They don't want to let go. Sometimes one's physician can be helpful in having that conversation with the family to have them to listen to the one who's the patient and say, you know, this is what your mother or this is what your sister wishes. And her wishes really are paramount. And as her physician, that would be my wish to follow through on those. And to also talk about what the implications are. And I don't think we do a good job of this. So when I say I want everything done for my mother, what does that really mean? Does that mean the physician will do CPR, break her ribs, from which she will probably never recover? She'll be suffering pain. Or my mother would be on a ventilator. Do I really want to put my mother through that? So I think we can have engaged physicians to help our family members have a realistic understanding of what we might be asking them to do that could actually be burdensome to the people we love.
And Dr. Zitter, before we go, what recommendations would you have for patients or for caregivers when dealing with end-of-life issues before we go?
I think, you know, it's all about upstreaming it. Don't wait until you're in the hospital, you know, in an extreme condition to have these conversations with your families. You know, play the game Go Wish, which is a terrific game that you can get online that will allow you to start having that conversation in a less threatening and slightly more fun way and just get those communication grease flowing.
You said Go Wish?
GoWish.org.
GoWish.org. I got to say, the ability to just talk about this is tough. It was hard for us to have the conversation, but once I was able to articulate what the line was for me, I felt better. It was a tough process, but it was worth it. And I appreciate y'all helping us make this tough process a little easier. Dr. Jessica Zitter of Highland Hospital in Oakland and author of Extreme Measures. Doctor, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Rosemary Gibson, senior advisor at the Hastings Center and the author of Treatment Trap. Thank you, Rosemary.
Thank you.
And Bud Hammes, executive director of Respecting Choices. Bud, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.